The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome, excuse me, to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. We're on today's show. I know we're going to knock out a couple of Social Security questions. We've got a follow-up to a previous answer we provided to a listener on a Social Security question. He provided us a little more detail. I know that. We've got maybe a bit of clarification or confirmation on a question we previously handled that we utilized an answer from the Ed Slot Group on a IRA-based question, but Jim will have the details on that. So I do have Jim in the remote studio again today. So,
otherwise known as the attic.
Yeah, but it's a nice cool day, so we're not going to hear him rant and rave about how uncomfortable it is in there.
No, it's actually remotely comfortable today, so yeah. I have something to look forward to as fall gets here. The attic is not nearly as hot as it is when it's sunny and 95 outside.
Oh.
But you did get to see the dead mouse for the first time. You've been up this way for...
I didn't even realize there was that place where those mouse traps were. So
yeah.
I'll have to monitor that situation and dispose of any mice.
Said dead mouse that's already there.
Mm-hmm.
See, I leave him there as a warning to the others.
It might be working because he's the only one there so far.
And all the time you've been up here, you never saw a mouse?
I have not the whole time. I have not seen one since I've been up
okay.
here.
So. I think it's the traps that are doing it, not the fact that there's no little critters. But they always stayed up here. As you saw, there's some sort of hole in the wall, and they kind of come up the plumbing and come out where the sink is.
Yeah.
From the basement, which is probably crawling with mice because it was built
That's
in 1905.
That's probably true. Yeah.
Yeah, that basement. You stay out of that basement.
I don't go down there
no,
for any reason.
No, you got to carry a cross with you in holy water if you go down in that basement. It's scary. Okay. So we've got some clarifications and then some Social Security questions and then some other questions. So the first thing, the Ed Slot clarification was from last week's EDU show, Chris, not an email question. If you remember, Ed came out with his little research report that he called RMD Relief, and he pointed out something that we had never known, and I would assume many of our listeners never knew, and that is if you are trying to replace a required minimum distribution taken in 2020 before the CARES Act came out and said you don't have to take RMDs in 2020. If you're trying to replace an RMD that is essentially in violation of the one per 365 day rule, that you have to put that RMD back to the same IRA it came from, which was never, ever, ever the rule on rollovers.
Right.
You could put a rollover back in any IRA. The IRS didn't care. But in Ed's research report, if you remember from last week on the Q&A show, we read the example that Ed gave. I think, I can't remember the name of the person that Ed named, but in his hypothetical example. But he was adamant that the money had to go back into the IRA it came from. And I said that I would reach out to him just to make sure he was right, which he was. But I'm going to read to you.
Yeah, that was a new twist that we hadn't picked up on before. And
one that I think is going to burn some people.
Yeah, and I haven't heard or seen anyone else talking about this. So Ed better get the word spread far and wide, or people are going to get, with an honest mistake, they're going to treat it just like any other rollover and not be worried about where it goes back into, only to find out, possibly, if the IRS ever looks into it, that they did it wrong. So it's... this is also one of those where we'll hope that the IRS doesn't peer at them too closely. They'll have a lot of other things to look at for 2020 because it's kind of a chaotic year.
Exactly. So I went back and read his research report twice before sending the email, and it added a little more clarity. I may have thought, I don't want to say wrong on it, but I was thrown by the examples he was using. The examples always had, if you remember, someone took an RMD in January, February, and March. Took one in January, one in February, one in March. So he's talking about people who took their annualized RMDs monthly. So they figured out what they had to take, but they took a little every month. So I thought that that was what... the rule was written for was for people who took multiple RMDs. The rule, though, is written for anyone, and I'll read his answer verbatim in a second, but the rule is for anyone, Chris, who is in violation of the one per 365-day rule. And that one per 365-day rule, folks, that's for a rollover. An indirect rollover kind of just goes by the name rollover, but technically it's an indirect rollover as opposed to a direct rollover, which is when money rollovers are always when money goes from a 401k to an IRA. And a direct rollover is when it goes directly from a 401k to an IRA. That's called a direct rollover. An indirect rollover is when money comes to you, be it from a 401k, Chris, or an IRA. It comes to you first, and then you can take up to 60 days to get it into another account. Follow me so far?
So far.
Okay. So what Ed is talking about, anyone in violation of the one per 365-day rule, which applies not to direct rollovers, but indirect rollovers. When you touch the money first, the check is written out to you first. You cash it, and then you deposit the money within 60 days to another retirement account, which prior to this ruling that came out, you could put it in any retirement account, but the government, the IRS, limited you to one of those indirect rollovers per 365-day period per taxpayer. Prior to the Barbro case, which came out a few years ago, the IRS used to apply that, Chris, if you remember, per IRA. And then tax court came out and said, no. The IRS was wrong for all these years. I mean, for years, the IRS said it was per IRA. And in the Barbro case, the tax court came out and said, no, it's per taxpayer, one per year. So Ed explained in his answer that if someone is in violation of that rule, Chris, so let's say they did a rollover in... 2019, say November of 2019, and then they took money out of their IRA as an RMD in February, March, April, it doesn't matter, of 2020, even after the CARES Act, they are in violation of the one per year rule. And technically speaking, they would not have been allowed to put that money back into an IRA. Not to mention it's an RMD, and RMDs were never allowed to go back into an IRA. But the CARES Act said no RMDs for 2020. So all of a sudden, what once was an RMD is no longer an RMD. But it still is considered a rollover. So as we talked about on last week's EDU show, they changed the name rollover to repayment, if you remember that, Chris. And that's the way the IRS got around it. They're saying it's a repayment. But Ed confirmed they mandate that money be repaid to the IRA it came from. So here is the answer directly from the Ed Slot group. I won't read my email to them. And they write, the requirement to pay back multiple required minimum distributions to the same IRA is a way to bypass the one rollover per year rule. The IRS will allow multiple rollovers. In the example we gave, like a person who took a monthly RMD payment in January, February, and March. But they, meaning the IRS, stipulate that they must go back to the same IRA account. Technically, they are going to be called repayments, which is the way to dance around the one, quote-unquote, rollover per year rule.
Yep.
The IRS will not allow these repayments, quote-unquote repayments in this email, will not allow these repayments to go to different IRAs. Otherwise, they will not be considered repayments. That's pretty strict.
And yeah, but that's how they're going to distinguish them between rollovers, which would they'd be in violation of the law by allowing an extension on that or an exception to the 365-day rule that's now in place. So I see the tricky little thing they did there. They're calling them something else and placing slightly different rules on them to justify that they truly aren't a rollover. They're just a repayment.
So I pointed out to them back that I always thought the IRS considered your IRAs one big account. And then they replied, I get your point about IRAs all being one big IRA, but this is what the IRS has laid out for us. It remains to be seen how, and here's a good point, Chris. Look what he wrote. It remains to be seen how custodians will code all these quote unquote repayments and ensure no one gets dinged for violating the one per year rule with their RMD putbacks. So this is going to require the custodians to code the 1099s correctly as well, or there's just going to be it's going to be a mess. 2020 taxes with this is going to be a mess for some people.
Yeah.
But it is correct, folks. The money has to go back to the same IRA it came from if you are in violation of the one per year rule. If you aren't in violation of that, it can go back to any IRA prior to August 31st of this year. But if you are in violation of the one per year rule, it must go back to the same IRA.
Yep.
And how they're going to follow all this and track it, I don't think they are, Chris. And personally, listeners, I don't think they're going to come after people on it if it goes back to another IRA. There's no, I just don't see that. They don't have
there's
the
no real harm either.
There's no harm. Exactly. That's a good way of putting it. You're not harming anything. The money was put back. But technically speaking, it has to go to the same IRA.
Yeah.
Okay. We beat that horse to death. Let's move on. This is a follow-up, so two follow-ups. We're beginning with follow-ups. This is a follow-up email to a question that you answered already, we got a little bit more information. Mm-hmm. So here again, folks, we don't like the emails that are wicked long and get to a page or two or three or four like we've had. It's just too much for us to follow and answer on a radio show, a podcast. But sending us questions that don't have all the pertinent information also can cause problems because Chris and I have to assume things, and then sometimes we assume incorrectly. But we try to assume correctly. So if you remember the question of the man who was going to work to 70 and 4 months and then retire and was asking if he would be able to get 6 months back pay, do you remember that whole question?
Yeah, he was talking about not claiming Social Security until after he'd reached 70, specifically 70 and 4 months, and was asking questions about filing retroactively in order to pick up those missed payments. And at the time, I pointed out that there was really no reason to do that. He could file retroactively, but why was my question. Why didn't he just collect them in the first place instead of waiting past the date when they're maximum? They're not growing anymore after he reaches 70. So my suggestion was to just do it at 70 instead of 70 in 4 months. And then he filled in a little more of the reasons or the reason that he is wanting to wait to 70 in 4 months to retire.
Correct. So he emailed us back. And he said, we kind of partially answered his question. And then he wrote, I probably didn't give enough information to total understand my situation. I had asked if I retired when I turned 70 in 4 months, if I could apply for the 4 months as a back benefit. The reason I want to do this is so I would have enough earned income in the year I was going to retire to fully fund the maximum I can contribute to my Roth 401k, which is $26,000, and make a $7,000 Roth IRA contribution for my wife and I, which would be another $14,000. So you see, Chris, he needed to get enough earnings, and that was going to take to 70 and 4 months in order to fully fund $26,000 in a Roth 401k, $7,000 in a Roth IRA for him, and $7,000 in a Roth IRA for her. Now, as you and I talked before we started recording on this, when this email came in, that's a moot point, correct?
Right. He's somehow connecting the fact that he wants to work until 70 and 4 months to claiming Social Security at 70 and 4 months. You don't have to retire to claim Social Security. If you claim Social Security and are still working and under your full retirement age, which will be for most people listening, either 66 or 67 or somewhere in between, if you're younger than your full retirement age, then you have to worry about the earnings test having effect on your benefits. But the month you reach, specifically the day you reach your full retirement age, they track it by month, so I better should stick to month. But the point is, the moment you reach your full retirement age, the earnings test no longer applies. You can earn $5 million a year, and it has no effect on your Social Security benefit amount. So he can feel free to work to 70 in 4 months, or even beyond if he wants to. But if his magic, the specific target date he wants is 70 in 4 months of work, go ahead and do that. That doesn't take away from the fact that he could just claim Social Security at 70. He may as well do that. There's no reason to wait and then do it retroactively. You may as well collect the money on time rather than collecting it in arrears. I think he's overcomplicating it. And my guess is he thinks there's some reason why he shouldn't claim while he's still working. And that when he's 70 years old, that should not be the case. His earnings matter not when he's claiming his Social Security at that age. So I still will stick by my original recommendation that he go ahead and claim at 70, which would also unlock the door for his spouse to start collecting the spousal offset, since he will have claimed his own benefit. His wife in this story is already collecting, but her own is less than half of his full retirement age benefit, apparently. So she will get a bump up when he finally claims. go ahead and do it at 70, and she'll get the age 70 as well. And he would have the option even at 70 to claim 6 months retroactively, but he would give up half a year's worth of delayed retirement credits doing so. But he would still have that flexibility. But there's really no benefit I can imagine to him delaying past 70 and then trying to file retroactively. He may as well just claim right at 70 years old.
Exactly. And that's kind of what he asks. He continues. He says, the question that was not answered on the show is, can my wife apply for her spousal added benefit? And let me pause there, folks. What he means there, I'm guessing, is the spousal offset that Chris often says. Your spousal benefit is a factor of your benefit plus an offset to equal half of the PIA of the working spouse you're claiming for. Did I explain that correct, Chris?
Basically, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's what I think he means by the spousal added benefit. Mm-hmm. In short, folks, he goes on to say, she waited until her full retirement age to claim her benefit, and she will change over to her spousal benefit when I claim my Social Security. So what he was asking, Chris and listeners, is, hey, if I wait to 70 and 4 months to claim, again, we don't know why he's thinking he has to wait to 70 and 4 months. I think your reasoning makes sense, Chris. But if he waits to 70 and 4 months, he's asking, when I finally file at age 70, can my wife get her spousal benefits essentially for the 4 months that I waited past age 70 to claim? And Chris, that's a moot point as well.
Right, because there's, again, no reason for him to wait to 70 and 4 months. My understanding is, just for argument's sake, if you were to file a retroactive claim, the spousal benefits could also be paid retroactively as well. So the simple answer to his question is yes, she should be able to pick up those 4 months retroactively, because essentially they backdate your application as if you had filed, in his story, 4 months before he actually did. So everything that normally would have happened 4 months ago is allowed to happen, just like you'd claimed at that point. So my understanding is that would work. I will look. I'll look if there's a special call out for spousal offset that can't be claimed retroactively, but I'm not aware of one off the top of my head. But again, why do that? It's overcomplicating this. Just go in and file at 70, and her benefit will bump up, and you'll start collecting your benefit. You'll continue to work another 4 months and contribute to your Roths as you intended, and life will be good. I don't see, unless there's still another element he's not sharing with us that I'm missing here, but I think it's being overcomplicated.
Perfect. Okay, we're going to get to another Social Security question before we get to non-Social Security questions. So you have your choice. You haven't seen either one of these. I randomly chose them. One has to do with spousal benefits and child in care benefits with a foreign wife, and the other has to do with when they should claim or would claiming early cause her Social Security benefits to be lower than if she kept working. So which one would you like?
I'm fine with either one of those, probably. The foreign spouse one is probably okay. Sometimes there'll be a little twist on one of those that I might have to go look something up,
well,
but I think it's straightforward.
Let's do that one first, okay. Because he wrote to you on November of 2019, and he's retiring in 2020, and you took forever to answer his question.
I might have already answered this one, because I do remember answering one a while back for somebody that had this. So I might have replied to him directly.
Was he a Floridian?
That I don't recall. But okay. I do recall someone who married someone from another country. They already had a child who was coming over.
This
and
one has three coming
and,
over.
And things like that. So
okay, yeah. Well, I'll read this one then. Okay, so this is coming from a Floridian. Gave his real name, but we, as always, are going to protect his anonymity and call him George. Okay, it begins, hi, I came across your podcast last night, And that was in November 2019.
In the dark of winter.
In the dark of, well, it's Florida, so how cold is it in November in Florida? It's not that cold. I just came across your podcast last night, and I'd like to engage your assessment regarding my Social Security benefit. Here is a synopsis of my situation. I will be 66 in January. I'm on track to retire November of 2020. I have a defined benefit pension plan and decent deferred savings and investments. I remarried in April of 2019. My wife is immigrating here from India. It is a progress, and with backlogs, it probably won't be until spring or summer of 2020. Now, I will say, Chris, this was pre-COVID. This might have been delayed because of the whole COVID situation. But follow everything so far?
So far, yep.
Okay. She is quite a bit younger than me at just 44. So he's 66. His new wife is going to be 44. And I now have three stepdaughters, ages 10 to 17. I also just became aware that she may be eligible for a spousal benefit, not by her age, but by mere virtue of caring for a child under the age of 16. I would like to verify if that is true, and if so, would it make sense for me to start drawing my Social Security benefit as soon as I turn 66 so she can draw this benefit for a full 6 years?
Got it. So, there's a few things going on here. First of all, him marrying someone, even though they might be from another country, that still allows them to be entitled to a spousal benefit. As long as they meet the regular rules, you have to be married for an entire year before spousal benefits are available, and that person, that spouse, must have reached the age of 62 if claiming a spousal benefit. And you must, him in this case, will have had to have filed their own retirement benefit to unlock the door for the spousal benefit. Those are the general rules for the spousal benefit itself. It doesn't matter that they that he married someone from another country. The twist on this is that certain people can file a spousal benefit ignoring the age 62 part of the rules. The other rules apply, but the age 62 part of it is waived if that spouse is caring for a child of the number holder, which is him in this case, the person upon which they're claiming all these benefits. And it turns out that stepchildren do apply here. Stepchildren do qualify. In this case, some people think it has to be a blood relative to be considered a child for child in care. That's not true. As long as you're married they're a benefit, they're a dependent, they count.
Chris, does he have to legally adopt them?
Nope. They can be stepchildren. Legal adoption, they're no longer stepchildren. They're actually his kids. But in this case, they'd be stepchildren, and they do count for purposes of this. And one of the children most likely isn't going to help them out, the 17-year-old, but the younger than 16-year-olds would qualify for child in care or benefits themselves, and also trigger, since they're under 16, the child in care. Now the children all could qualify for dependent benefits as long as they were under the age of 18 or under 19 and still attending high school. So there's two different benefits going on here. There's three. There's his benefit, and then the auxiliary benefits would be the benefits directly for the children, as well as if the child is also under the age of 16, the mother can claim a spousal benefit, even though she hasn't turned 62 yet. So that's what child and care benefits are all about. We've talked about them in greater detail in previous podcasts, but it's a way to get around that age 62 issue. So there are some people who marry a younger spouse. They've claimed their own benefit, unlocking the door. Kids are young enough that they get a benefit, and the spouse, in this case the mother, claims a benefit for a while until the youngest turns 16, and then the mother's benefit, in this case, would turn off. The kids would continue collecting a potential benefit until they turned 18 or 19 and still going to high school. And then when she turned 62, the door would open back up again for her spousal benefit to restart. Although at that point, if she claimed it at 62, it would be reduced because she hasn't reached her full retirement age yet. A lot of words there, a lot of things going on. But yes, the only element here that needs to be added is there will be a cap. There's the family maximum at work here. And he will likely be able to, in total, only be able to collect about 182 percent of his benefit in total for the family. So it's actually not going to matter that there's so many on here. It will add to, actually the total amount when there's a couple of kids under 16 or so, and actually there's three total under 18 when he wrote this, because the oldest was 17 years old. He'll have reached the family maximum before she even claims. So I do believe, I remember this now that you've mentioned all these details, and I'm pretty sure I did respond to him directly. But there are qualifying events or qualifying status of all these different people for benefits, but it's all going to be capped by that family maximum, which is, like I said, maxes out at about 182%. So what that means is if his benefit was $2,000, the most additional benefits that he could get for his spouse and kids combined would be about another $1,600 a month if his benefit was $2,000. So there are limits. It's not the, you might be thinking, oh my gosh, there's three kids and a wife here. There's going to be tons of benefits coming in. That's where the family maximum kicks in. So hopefully that kind of clarified things. He was probably curious about two things, I'm guessing. The fact that she was from another country, did that change the rules at all? No. And the fact that they were stepkids, did that change it? And the answer there would be no.
Right. And then he asked, I'm not sure if it was rhetorically or if he wanted our opinion, should he do this? Should he file so she can claim? I think that you've got to really crunch the numbers on.
Yeah, he hasn't given me enough details to do a, you know, pros and cons on this. So a lot of times it does make sense, but it is going to be a limited period of time that they collect these.
Exactly. Only 6 years, the max.
The maximum, that's just for the child, that one child. So there is 6 years here. How old was the spouse that he was marrying?
44.
44. Okay. So there'd be payments for quite a while, then there'd be a big gap before she could claim spousal benefits again. The concern I would have with claiming earlier than later is that later in life, he's likely to predecease her. The age difference and the gender difference, statistically, odds are highly in favor of him predeceasing her. And at that time, whatever benefit he was receiving would be the benefit payable to her. And if it's permanently reduced because of him claiming early to get this little 6-year benefit, there might be some issues long term, but again, we don't understand. We don't know the details about all the rest of his stuff that he's got. He said he's, you know, has other resources, etc. But we'd have to know kind of the whole picture to see how Social Security would fit into that overall situation.
Right. My gut tells me initially people are going to be, oh, let's get the money now. A bird in the bushes is worth two in the hand. So let's get. Did I say that right? Bird in the bush is worth two in the hand. Yeah, I said that right.
No, it's the other way around. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush.
No, I said...
No. A bird in the hand, you have it. Two in the bush means you could maybe catch them, but they have a chance of getting away. So you're comparing... You're guaranteed to have one if it's in your hand.
I was so close.
You were close, but backwards.
I was close.
Just shift it around.
Whatever. You get the point. Should I get my gratification now or later? And that's the thing... I think the extra money now, yeah, that's pretty nice. But with this massive age difference, that the spouse could have a spousal benefit for 30 years or more. And if he claims early, he's locking his spouse into a lower benefit later.
For a very long period of time.
Now, yeah. If he's got ample assets where there's absolutely no problem, or a large life insurance policy on his life, and he's going to leave his spouse plenty of money to make up the difference. Or if his spouse might be 22 years younger than him, but in very bad health and may not live long herself, there's any number of variables we could look at that would make us answer this question one way or another. And it's a tough one to answer without more info. Don't send us more info, listener, because we're not going to be able to crunch it all for you. I'm just trying to give you an idea of other things you're going to have to look at if you decide to do this or not. Capiche?
Capiche.
Okay. Next one is a little bit kind of an annuity, either a question or a point that he's trying to make. I agree with this listener, and I thought it would kind of clear the air about some of our thoughts on annuities and how we do things. So this email came in not too long ago, February of 2020, just as COVID was hitting. And he writes, "Hi, Jim and Chris." This is from a Californian, and as always, we are going to call him George. And it begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. I was listening to your podcast you did at the beginning of February, and one of your callers..." So it must have been on one of our live call shows, I guess, Chris. Mm-hmm. "One of your callers was 52 years old and was asking you guys about putting $250,000 into a deferred income annuity for 8 years. Oh, excuse me, for 18 years. Mm-hmm. Or investing his $250,000 for 18 years and then buying a single premium immediate annuity with the projected $1,050,000 he would have at age 70, assuming his 8% growth rate happened." I think I remember that because the 8% was rather high in our opinion. Mm-hmm. And he even wrote, "Not sure if he will get 8% or not." Okay, so let me just clear the air here a little bit, listeners, about what that show is about and what this listener is pointing out. So the caller needed some additional secure income, and he could put $250,000 into a deferred income annuity today or buy an immediate annuity, otherwise known as a single premium immediate annuity, or SPIA, which is its acronym, S-P-I-A, SPIA, and a deferred income annuity often goes by DIA, D-I-A. Deferred income annuity. Not to be confused in the state of Colorado with Denver International Airport, which also goes by DIA. Okay, and I can't remember what we specifically said to him, but I know you and I, Chris, we take the adage, 18 years is a very long time. And if you put the money in a deferred income annuity, granted, the insurance company is now contractually obligated to pay you the income they promised, irrespective of what happens in the economy. So it's one way to remove investment risk, Chris, economic risk, interest rate risk. You can remove a lot of risks. You get carrier risk. You get the risk of the insurance company that it might go out of business during that 18-year period. But you try to battle that by buying a product from a highly rated insurance company, but you can remove a lot of risk with a DIA. I think we would admit that. We'll give DIAs credits for that, correct?
True.
But notice Chris was a little hesitant in that. True. We have an issue with someone buying a deferred income annuity for a perceived income shortage that might happen in 18 years. And what's that, Chris?
Well, you're committing to something where there's a lot of time for things to change. Maybe your circumstances change completely. Maybe your life expectancy changes due to a medical event. Maybe there's a family change that would affect how you're going to work, you know, deal with retirement. There's all these variables that are up in the air during that 18-year period. And you've locked yourself into, yes, you have a bit of the surety of the contract from the insurance, but it is likely not to be as flexible. Well, it's not definitely not going to be as flexible or as liquid as having those assets outside of that contract. And that is worth a lot. People underestimate the value of flexibility and liquidity. We agree that if you want to set it and forget it, you could eliminate an unknown for yourself. You are now entered into a relationship with the insurance company where you know they're going to give you X amount 18 years from now. And you can just count on that. And if you value that known amount a lot, it might be somewhat attractive, but you have to realize you are giving up all of the ability to be flexible and react to the events that happen over the next 18 years. And we feel that there's just too much that could happen that might change the story, either the amount or even the desire to have that income annuity at all during that period.
Exactly. So in the original call, folks, the listener could put $250,000 in a DIA or $250,000 in an investment account. And he projected he would earn 8% on it. And then he would have a little bit over $1 million in his calculation that he could then use to buy a single premium immediate annuity, which he felt would generate the income he needed. So those are his two options. So the listener today, Chris, in the email continues. I'm not sure if he would get the 8% or not. And you and I had mentioned we don't think he'll get the 8% either, but who knows? But in my opinion, either of the two options are risky. For one, I think committing to a deferred income annuity at age 52 is far too conservative, and putting 100% of your money in equities is also the opposite, far too risky. So I agree with him. At least on the DIA, he says it's too conservative. A DIA is always going to be conservative, Chris, because you're buying a guarantee. So there's absolutely no risk, but there's a guarantee. And yes, we believe, for the reasons Chris shared, listener, that a 52-year-old buying a deferred income annuity for something that he was going to need at age 70 is too conservative, but it's also too risky in the sense you're locked into it. When you buy a deferred income annuity or a single premium immediate annuity, it is an irrevocable decision. And to me, that's where the risk is, Chris, he's calling it too conservative. I'm calling it risky. I think it's risky for a 52-year-old to lock up money to the 70-year-old him, and he doesn't know if the 70-year-old him is really going to need it.
Plus, I don't recall that he said that was all of his money.
I don't believe it was all of his money.
This person pointing it out is saying that, well, comparing put it all in a DIA or put it all in equities, I think he's creating a false choice there, because I agree, those aren't the two choices that a person faces when they have $250,000 available to them. They can do all kinds of things with it. Two choices would be a DIA and 100% in equities, but you can do all kinds of other things too. Create a much more diversified approach via, you know, not just equities or some blend of things.
And where you're going is the very next paragraph, Mr. Chris.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So even the listener today in his email says, why not, paragraph two, why not split the difference and purchase laddered MIGAs? Another acronym, folks, stands for multi-year guaranteed annuity. So he says, why not split the difference and purchase laddered MIGAs with $125,000 and invest the other $125,000 in equities? Essentially, Chris, he's saying, why not create a moderate investment portfolio, 50% fixed income, 50% equities, but instead of using traditional fixed income holdings like a bond fund or individual bonds, it would be hard with $125,000 just to get individual bonds. There's not much dollars there. Yeah. But bond funds or, in his case, excuse me, using MYGAs. MYGAs stand for, again, folks, multi-year guaranteed annuity, and they're an insurance company version, for lack of a better term, of a CD, minus the FDIC insurance, because you're not going to get that with a MYGA. But they work the same way. You would buy a certain term MYGA, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and they will guarantee a certain amount of interest during that deferral period. The interest grows tax deferred. You don't pay any taxes on it. Now, if this money is inside an IRA, that's a moot point. If the money is outside of an IRA, that might be beneficial. I don't know. But he's essentially saying, Chris, why invest all of it in equities? Why don't you put half in a MYGA and half in equities? I'm not going to dispute that. Now, if you think interest rates are going to continue to go down, and I don't know how much lower they can go from where they are now, which is pretty damn low, about 0.6% or so on the 10-year bond. But if interest rates were to keep going lower, you might get some capital appreciation on your bonds. But holding bonds exposes you a tremendous amount of interest rate risk if interest rates go up, whereas the MYGA kind of insulates you from the interest rate risk, at least, Chris, during the term of the multi-year guaranteed annuity.
Right. And one other point I want to point out to people if they didn't pick up on it. MYGAs, all of the growth slash interest you're being credited with is deferred, which is different than a CD. A CD, if you're putting a substantial amount in here, you're going to be recognizing interest income every single year, even though it's in a 2-3-4 year CD, where as a MYGA, it's all deferred in there, which I'm pointing this out because for people who are really trying to manage their tax situation, particularly during their tax planning window, this would be a key differentiator between a MYGA and a CD to worry about. If you're trying to minimize the amount of other income being recognized, like interest income, that would provide a reason to be preferable in a MYGA instead.
Exactly. We've given that advice on the show before to use either a MYGA or a fee-only variable annuity to shield bank and brokerage account money that might be generating interest and dividends, Chris, that are pushing you out of qualifying for ACA, Affordable Care Act, premium tax credits.
Yep.
Well, during that deferral phase where you're trying to get the premium tax credit, just put the money that is causing this problem into an annuity wrapper, and all the interest and dividends being generated are not taxed that year. And on paper, you can still look poor and qualify for the ACA. And then when you no longer qualify for ACA because you're on Medicare, you're over the age of 65, then you can start unwinding those annuity positions and getting the money out of the annuity. So we have talked about doing something similar to that. So he goes on to say, if the listener used the MYGA option, it would give you the option of not annuitizing it at the end of the term. And that's, we have pointed out repeatedly on this show. Hopefully listeners remember this, because this listener from California, who we're going to call George, is correct what he's pointing out there. The MYGA, through a multi-year guaranteed annuity, unlike a DIA, a deferred income annuity, a DIA is where you give the insurance company a lump sum of money, and they're saying, okay, no problem. We promise you this much in income at this point in the future. Whereas a MYGA, you give a lump sum of money, but the insurance company promises you, Chris, your principal back and a certain amount of interest during that term. They're not promising you income. They're promising you a return of your principal and a guaranteed amount of interest. Whereas the DIA doesn't promise you your principal, Chris. It promises you a certain amount of income for the rest of your life. So he's correctly pointing out the listener from the original, excuse me, the caller from the original February call that we took would have more flexibility if he or she utilized a MIGA over a deferred income annuity. And then he wanted to point out if all the funds were in a qualified account, meaning an IRA, everything would be taxed as ordinary income when it's taken out. But if it's in a taxable account, it would be better, since the stock investments will be taxed at capital gains and the funds in the MIGA would be taxed using the exclusion ratio when annuitized. So let me just clarify a little bit about what he's saying there. When the time comes, Chris, at age 70, if the person did do this strategy. Now, you're going to have to buy a series of laddered MIGAs, first of all. Mm-hmm. So remember, the listener is only 52, the original caller, needs the money at 70, 18 years from now. So when you buy a MIGA, you buy a certain term. And right now, Chris, 3- and 5-year MIGAs are paying more than 7- and 10-year MIGAs, which is telling you the insurance company doesn't have much faith in long-term rates going up.
Right.
So no one is going to buy a 7- or 10-year MIGA paying less than a 3- or 5-year MIGA, unless you think in another 4 years, when the 3-year comes due, interest rates are going to be even lower than they are now, and you want to lock in rates for 7 or 10 years, even though they're lower than you could get a 3-year MIGA for or a 5-year MIGA for. But irrespective, Chris, of whatever you do for laddering your MIGAs, the person trying to do this, the 52-year-old, they're going to have to buy a series of MIGAs.
Right. And they can roll them. So exactly. You can keep rolling and deferring. Mm-hmm.
And that's the key I wanted to point out. No big deal. Because you're not going to buy an 18-year MIGA. And that's not what this listener is advocating. So even if you did a series of 3- and 5-year ones, when a MIGA matures, it will renew automatically, usually within 30 days, at whatever interest rates for a new term are. And if you bought a 3-year, it'll renew into a 3-year. If you bought a 5-year, it'll renew into a 5-year. For the most part, there are a couple of insurance companies that will renew it monthly, Chris, not annually over the previous term. But those companies are few and far between and pay much less in interest than the companies that give you 30 days to make up your mind. Very similar to a bank CD. You get that letter that your CD is maturing. You have 30 days to tell the bank what to do. Are they going to buy another termed CD? If you had a 5-year CD, they're going to put you in another 5-year CD. Well, if you have a 5-year MIGA, Chris, they're going to put you in another 5-year MIGA. But do you have to pay taxes on that?
Putting the money into the MIGA?
Back into a MIGA. MIGA to MIGA. No, no taxes.
No tax event at that point.
You don't pay taxes if you keep the money in an annuity, folks. So even if the MIGA matures, you can... I'll use the term roll it, but that's not really what it is. It's 1035 exchange is what right. You're doing. And you're moving the money from one annuity to another. It's just renewing tax deferred. Only when you take the money out of the MIGA do you pay taxes on it. And that's the other thing he's pointing out. If you took that MIGA in the future, in 18 years, you've got all this income built up in it. So you put, in his example, $125,000 in. Let's say in 18 years, Chris, it's worth $250,000. I'm just making these numbers up to do some math here. If you move that $250,000 MIGA into a SPIAS, single premium immediate annuity, at that point, which is how this strategy works, if you move it from the MIGA into a SPIA, no taxes are owed when you move it. So that $125,000 gain over 18 years, in my example, goes into the SPIA tax deferred. And then when the SPIA starts paying you, the insurance company is going to calculate what is known as an exclusion ratio.
Right.
And they're going to say, okay, a certain amount of this payment is a return of your already taxed money that you originally put into the series of MIGAs you purchased. And a portion of the payment is all the deferred interest inside the MIGAs that you have never been taxed on. In my rather simplistic example, the exclusion ratio would be what, Chris?
I didn't follow the math or write it down. I didn't know there was going to be a test at the end. But
you put in 125.
About half, so.
Right. Yeah. You put in 125 and it grew to 250.
Yep.
So it doubled. Mm-hmm. So
no, well, the exclusion ratio isn't going to be half.
They'll be 50%.
No.
Well, it'll be a little bit off, but
it'll
be
different
close.
Because the insurance, yeah, the insurance company that's paying you the SPIA also has to account for some of the quote interest that they're embedding in the contract as well.
True.
So
it'll be very close to 50%.
It'll be close, but it is a little more complicated than what Jim alluded to.
I'm just trying to keep
but
things
I
simple.
Know, I'm just, but we try to be as accurate
true,
as possible.
True, we try to be as accurate as possible. So Chris is correct. The insurance company has to impute the amount of interest that you're going to earn as well, which will be taxable to you over the course of your life. And I'll go deeper into the weeds as well. So what happens is you get an exclusion ratio, which in my example isn't going to quite be 50-50. It might be, oh, I don't know. What do you think? 45, 55, somewhere around there?
Probably. Like
somewhere around
like 55% of it will be tax.
Right, and 45% tax-free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, the insurance company sets the exclusion ratio. It's not up to negotiation.
The good news is they're the ones who calculate it. There is a way to calculate it, so it's not like a negotiation where they're just coming up with it out of the air. There is a calculation there. The good news is you don't have to do it. They
do
it for you.
The insurance company does it.
Yep.
They must track it. And when you receive all of your $125,000 basis, remember, in this gentleman's example, you put $125,000 in. I said over the course of 18 years, it grew to $250,000. It doubled. So that's how we came up with our exclusion ratio. As Chris pointed out, the embedded interest is also going to have to be factored in, so it won't quite be 50-50. Let's just pretend it's 45-55. So that means the insurance company is going to track the $125,000 that you put in that comes back to you tax-free. And when you have received all of it, then 100% of the SPIA payments become taxable.
Right.
And the insurance company will track that and send you a 1099 every year, so you don't have to worry about it. But at some point in the future, you'll notice all of a sudden, boom, you're going to get a 1099, and it's all taxable, when it used to be, in our example, a 45-55 split or whatever the actual number comes to.
And this will occur at about the insurance company's determination of your mortality expectation age.
Exactly. Okay, so he just wanted to point out that he thought his approach would be more flexible and safer. I'm not going to dispute either of those. I think it definitely is flexible. Is it safer? I technically speaking, I think it is, but one could play devil's advocate and find reasons why it may not be quite as safe as you think. But I'm not going to go down that route. I like the idea. It is definitely a possibility. I like it more with interest rates this low because MIGAs right now, a 3-year MIGA or a 5-year MIGA will pay around 2.5% to 3%, whereas a 10-year bond, Chris, is only paying 0.6%, and the 10-year bond is exposed to rising interest rates that can really hurt your principal, whereas if interest rates rise and you have a MIGA paying you 3%, you're not going to lose one red cent of principal. It's 100% protected. And when that MIGA matures, if it's not going to renew at a competitive interest rate, you can simply move it, Chris, to another MIGA at another insurance company that's paying more. Mm-hmm. So you could benefit from rising interest rates without losing principal. That's why I wanted to get to this question today. When he asked it a year ago, well, almost a year ago, well, not really a year ago, he asked it in February, interest rates were higher before all this happened, and I say Hiya in quotation marks or with raised eyebrows, because even then they were still pretty damn low. But if interest rates go up, the MIGA, I think, is going to give you more protection than bonds. Bonds are not risk-free. And at these low interest rate levels, bonds, I think, are carrying far more risk than people realize, especially to principal, and especially in bond funds, where you don't have the luxury of hopefully holding a bond to maturity or to its call date and hopefully getting your par back, unless you bought a premium bond, at which case you might be faced with a loss. But in a bond mutual fund, which does give you the diversity, you still are going to carry a lot of interest rate risk where your principal could drop. The MIGA, you're not going to lose one red cent. You are paying for the protection of principal. And I think right now a 2.5 to 3% interest rate, Chris, on a 3 to 5 year MIGA compared to what a bond is paying, it's pretty darn sweet. And if interest rates go up during that time frame, oh horror, it's going to renew at a higher interest rate. And if it doesn't, you're just going to move it to a company that will pay you a higher interest rate. And they'll be out there because MIGAs are very competitive. So there'll be some insurance company willing to pay you more than the other. Whereas if you have bond funds and interest rates go up over the next 3 to 5 years, you could be sitting on a loss of principal. So I think it is a safer approach, and I like it more in these lower interest rate environments. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is certainly an alternative to the all or nothing, which he kind of proposed. As I don't think we were trying to say that was the situation, and I don't think the original listener who wrote the questioner posed this story to us was necessarily implying that all of his wealth was in this $250,000. But yeah, I think if whatever amount he does have, a blended approach, a diversified approach at this point does make sense. I like that he's thinking about generating secure income, but I honestly don't think a whole lot of 52-year-olds need to be worried about generating secure income yet. It's all about contributing to savings and investments and deferrals if you're doing those in sufficient quantities while you're working during your peak earnings years, which are supposed to be in your 50s, so that you can have a lot of resources available to do any number of things once you finally retire, one of which might be to generate secure income. But we're fans of staying flexible earlier, not committing to this quite so young at this point until the fog clears a bit. And
by committing,
idea,
you mean buying the deferred income annuity.
Right.
I have no problem with the original person, not California George, who just sent us today's email comment/question, but the original person. I admire someone at 52 trying to do the calculations, figure out what the younger him needs to put aside to take care of the older him, and start trying to put a plan in place to protect that. So I have no problem with that. I would have a problem with a 52-year-old buying a DIA, because remember, deferred income annuity, folks, is irrevocable, whereas laddered MIGAs, which is what today's listener wanted to comment on, laddered MIGAs gives you much more flexibility. Your money is only locked up for the term of the MIGA. And if your term is 3 years or 5 years, that's not that long of a term. And you can always get it out before, you just pay a penalty. But if this is truly being earmarked for your minimum dignity floor and protecting it, I don't think you're going to take it out early. The whole point, Chris, was you want to put in place a plan that will help take care of your minimum dignity floor. And if you want to do it in a safe and sure way with some of your money, and I don't have any problem with that. A lot of you do-it-yourselfers, it's all about, oh, what am I going to earn? What am I going to earn? I could earn more on this if I did this with it or that with it. But you're taking on all that risk. If you just want something simple for the older you and allow you to be more aggressive with your remaining money because you know you're future minimum dignity floor is taken care of, I like the idea of a 52-year-old putting in place a plan to begin generating the secure income he's going to need, Chris, in 18 years at age 70. I agree with today's commenter that doing it all in a DIA is a little bit out of my comfort zone because a lot can happen in that 18-year period. And a DIA, unlike a MIGA, is irrevocable. A MIGA is not irrevocable. You get your money totally back, 100% protected at the end of the term with the guaranteed interest that you're assured during the term. Or, God forbid, if worse came to worse, you could sell it during the term, pay a penalty, which will probably be pretty steep, Chris. I would say somewhere between 5 and 7%. So the penalty is pretty steep, but they do that to keep you from cashing it in frivolously. Did I get it?
Kind of, yeah.
Uh-huh. Cool.
Finally.
Got it. Wow. That's
it was painful to listen to, but...
I could hear you almost laughing from the other room.
Oh, I wasn't almost laughing. I was chuckling.
I could hear it. Frivolously.
You're throwing in extra R's there. It's that Boston thing again. Those extra R's just end up...
Why do we put
up?
R's where they don't belong and don't put them where they do belong?
I don't know. It's a genetic thing, I think.
Oh, goodness. Well, that's a new word that came out of nowhere. Anyways, I think we made our case clear on here. I just thought it was an interesting email that would allow us to comment a lot and explain a lot of things. But right now, folks, I'm more attracted to MIGAs than I am bond funds right now. But that's just me. Now, there is investment advisors. Remember, we're planners. So we like the safety and the surety and the forward-lookingness and the planning. Investment advisors, especially those who want to manage your money and get 1% a year managing them, they're not going to be too keen on MIGAs because they're not going to be able to charge their 1% asset management fee on the money inside of MIGA. But I kind of like in these low interest rate environments, if you think interest rates eventually going to go up, the MIGA gives you the principal protection, and then when it renews, oh, horror, you renew at a higher interest rate. So it can be good. Conversely, if you think interest rates are going to go down, you may not want to get the MIGA because you're going to lose the capital appreciation, Chris, that a bond can give you or a bond fund can give you when interest rates are dropping. But at 6/10 on the 10-year, granted, they can still drop and maybe go negative someday. But there's not much more milk to squeeze out of that rock. The interest rate rock.
Milk, you said?
Milk out of a rock.
Let's not go there, because...
Oh, no, 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 no. That is a saying. You can't get milk out of a rock.
Okay.
No?
It seems awkward to me, but...
You never heard that saying?
No.
It's like getting milk out of a rock?
I've heard blood from a turnip.
No, you don't get blood from a turnip.
I know, that's the point.
Maybe
you don't
a beet, because a beet is red.
It's the same meaning, though. You can't get blood from a turnip, just like in your phrase, you can't get milk from a rock. I've never tried to milk a rock, nor heard that, but it kind of means the same thing, so we can go with it.
All right. Blood from a turnip, or milk from a rock. Okay. Do you have time for another Social Security question?
Yeah, I mean, if it's short, we have time.
All right. All right, this is a joint and survival one.
Okay.
Greetings, Jim and Chris. Hope all is well in Colorado. This is from a North Carolinian. I wonder if he's near Asheville, the newest place in the United States I'm thinking of maybe retiring to. He does write, he gave his real name, but we're going to call him George, from North Carolina, formerly Illinois, so I have driven through Kentucky.
Oh, nice.
He didn't stop. He just apparently kept going.
Windows up, air conditioning on.
Okay. Greetings, Jim and Chris. Hope all is well in Colorado. My wife and I are fortunate that we both have pensions from our employers. They're very fortunate to have that. Mm-hmm. When the time comes to choose the payment, oh, wait a minute, this isn't a Social Security question. I'm reading the wrong question. Should I keep going with this now or switch to Social Security question?
We can go with this one.
You want to go with this one?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. My wife and I are fortunate in that we both have pensions from our employers. When the time comes to choose the payment option for them, How should we determine which option to choose? They give us a lump sum, a single life, a 50% joint and survivor, and 100% joint and survivor, and a modified joint and survivor. I'm not quite sure what the modified joint survivor would be.
It's probably one with a what's called a pop-up.
Ah, yes, that's right. So if one of them dies, it pops up.
Yep.
Okay. I know that from an actuarial standpoint, all the options are equivalent based on life expectancy.
Yeah, so if you were an insurance company, that would matter.
To the insurance company, yes.
To you, we don't like looking at it that way, but...
But anyways, here's the meat and potatoes, because it's a short question. But how should we choose what we should do? If your answer is, quote unquote, it depends, and this question cannot be answered without doing an analysis, could you please provide general thoughts and guidelines? We would appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can't just answer it right out, Chris, this is what you should do, can you give some guidelines?
I can describe how one might go about determining this in the method that we use to determine this. How about that?
Correct, because with the information he gave us, we can't tell
right.
him which
we,
one to
we can't
choose.
Tell. So if you're buying into our whole philosophy where we believe that you have a set of expenses that we call minimum dignity floor expenses that are required and will be needing to be paid through the rest of your life, no matter how long you live, minimum dignity floor, as a reminder, includes everything you buy at the grocery store. That's really the expansion on food because, you know, toiletries and paper products and stuff. We call it food as a slang term or a short description, but it's really more everything that comes from the grocery store. So food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, those five elements have to be met throughout your entire life. No matter what you're doing above and beyond that for fun, these minimum dignity floor items must be satisfied. And we propose that you protect those in a way that they're not exposed to assets being running out or depleting, but instead are funded by what we call secure income. Secure income will mirror the behavior of those expenses. They will continue every single year. If they move at all, they go up along with the inflation of those expenses, which will tend to happen. But it won't go down. It's backed by a third party with deep pockets, not backed by your own assets, and it will go as long as these expenses go, all the way until you pass away. But the twist that comes in is what he's referring to is what happens in a survivorship scenario. We can model all this and do our budget based on a couple, maybe living to 93 or 95 and then peacefully dying together in their sleep, that most likely isn't going to happen. So there might be a period where one or the other is living alone, which would, in your budgeting, when you try to figure this out for yourself, you need to try to predict what will the minimum dignity floor look like for the survivor. It'll be lower than as a couple, but not a lot lower, because a lot of these expenses take utilities and household expenses, and I would argue even food, although food should cut in half, but most people, there's more waste, so it wouldn't even necessarily do that. But the point is, some will drop, some won't, so there'll be some element of reduction of the minimum dignity floor, but you have to make sure that whatever secure income doesn't drop so drastically at the first passing that the survivor is left in a precarious situation without coverage of the minimum dignity floor with secure income. Now, this isn't a universal planning technique. This is our approach to it. But if you're listening to us and buying into what we're doing, that is the method we would use. So you could do this on your own. This is something that we do in our base retirement plan for people, is we establish the minimum dignity floor. We predict what it's going to look like in a survivorship scenario if one or the other of the spouses were to pass away and leave the other for an extended single retirement. And we then look at their income sources, their secure income, which would be Social Security, pensions like they have. They didn't mention if they have Social Security. They might have only the pensions, but maybe they have Social Security too. And then maybe they have some income annuities. Some people do. And we look at that and compare then the minimum dignity floor with that secure income and look if the projections show that the secure income will be substantial enough to satisfy that minimum dignity floor in a couple situation and in a survivor situation. And this is where we can play with numbers a little bit, and you can do so too. assume you take the single life and look what it does to the survivor. If the reduction of income isn't substantial enough to jeopardize the minimum dignity floor, then the single life might be a good way to go, because that will give the couple you the most money coming in to enjoy during the time that you're alive together, but not jeopardize a survivor. But it's likely, there's very few people that have such massive pensions that opting for the single life leaves the survivor unharmed. It does happen. I had one recently, actually. We worked with somebody who their individual pensions were substantial enough combined with Social Security that loss of one of the pensions in its entirety still didn't jeopardize their minimum dignity floor. That's atypical. More often, the single life is generally not favorable. But it doesn't necessarily mean you have to pick the joint and 100%. That might leave the survivor with, I hate to say, too much secure income. I'm not sure you can technically have too much, but more than would be adequate to cover their minimum dignity floor, which if you want to leave them in a, such a rock solid position, you might prefer that. But you might find the joint in 50% is enough that with the drop in the minimum dignity floor and then half of one of the pensions going away and maybe a subsequent reduction of Social Security if you have that, you still have robust coverage of the minimum dignity floor with a joint in 50%. That's how to determine this. You didn't give us the numbers, so I can't do it for you, but that's how you would approach this if you wanted to kind of do it yourself and embrace our philosophy of how to cover the minimum dignity floor with the secure income.
Yeah, I would just throw in, also pay attention to life expectancy. If you have one spouse that just doesn't have good health and the other one does, you could also play the odds and that spouse takes a single life.
See, and I hate playing the odds in the minimum dignity floor, honestly, Jim. I prefer, this is surprising because of the two of us, you typically are more
conservative,
cautious than
I am.
I'm
much more cautious than you.
And not that I'm crazy, but I am a little less cautious typically than Jim. I am such a fan of making sure the minimum dignity floor is not compromised and not trying to play the odds at all in this regard, that I would throw that out unless it's an obvious extreme case where they have a very understandable medical condition where they are definitely, well, as close to definitely as possible, going to have a much shorter than average life expectancy. Factor that in. But if I would not factor in, so-and-so, you know, George's parents only lived to 73 and Georgette's parents lived to 90. So I'm sure that George is going to pass away early.
I don't mean to go that route, but if you have a congenital condition or a known condition,
if it's severe enough, I agree.
And you've been told, because remember, when you go and apply for a pension or an income annuity, you don't go through underwriting.
Right.
So the insurance company doesn't know your health. They use average health. And if you have less than average health, documentable less than average health, and you feel really confident, you've seen them, Chris. We've been working together for over 10 years. You've met clients who have told us point blank, I don't think I'm going to live past 80. I don't think I'm going to live past 85. I have this or I have that. And they ask us to use that in our calculations. And we don't argue with them in the sense they know their health better than we do. If you're playing the parents' odds, I'm against that. When
that was
people,
just an example of kind of finding the, just make sure you're factoring in something that is so significant and understood that it justifies this assumption of shorter than average life expectancy. The biggest risk in retirement is longevity. That's what this minimum dignity floor coverage with secure income is addressing directly. And I am really reluctant to start whittling away at that by playing the odds. That's my point. That's the only thing I'm saying.
No problem. I agree. And it's, again, a personal decision you have to do, folks, when you're trying to determine which pension option to take. I do want to remark, nowhere in his list of options did he list lump sum. And I like that. I like the fact, I'm guessing they work for governments and they don't have Social Security because he never mentioned Social Security. Okay. So they have two government pensions, no Social Security, I'm assuming on that one. But he didn't say, what if I took a lump sum? Or did he? Did I miss that part?
He didn't say what. He said that was available.
Oh, he
did.
He said it was there. One of the choices, lump sum, single life. Okay. Do be very careful in taking a lump sum.
Yeah.
Chris and I preach that all the time. Now, investment advisors, not planners, they may call themselves planners, but they're ultimately investment advisors looking to manage money under an asset under management approach. They have an incentive to have you have a hell of a lot more money, so they get paid a lot more. They love the lump sum payout. Chris and I, as planners, we look first at your minimum dignity floor needs. And remember, folks, as Chris has explained, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses continue forever, whether you have money or not. They should be covered with income that continues forever, whether you have money or not. And we're not getting younger, stronger, and healthier as you go through retirement. And your ability to understand financial concepts, and I know a lot of our do-it-yourselfers don't like when I say this, but your ability to understand financial concepts does diminish as you age. It's a bell curve. It's not a perfect curve. Most of us are right there in the middle, where our ability and interest in understanding financial concepts will diminish, but there will be people to the left of the curve who will never miss anything, and people to the right of the curve who never liked it to begin with. But the majority of us will lose our ability to understand financial concepts. That's why we like pensions over lump sums. Lump sums have to constantly be managed. They have to constantly be looked at. You have to constantly understand what the hell is going on. But as an 85-year-old or an 87-year-old or a 93-year-old, you are going to remember or at least understand, Chris, whatever day of the month your pension or annuity or Social Security check is being deposited into your account. My dad knows the third Wednesday of the month. Why? Because that's when he gets his Social Security check.
I'll point out one other thing on the lump sum. I have people ask me this all the time. Someone just asked me this yesterday. What's the number one mistake I see retirees make? I won't necessarily say this is number one, but one of the top few is taking the lump sum for bad reasons. And the number one bad reason I can share with you, because everyone else at the company is doing that. It's almost like a nefarious evil rumor that got started by someone who got spread, and people just start to embrace it and start tanking it without analyzing the consequences or considering the options. Doesn't mean that at times it doesn't make sense to take the lump sum. If it's a pension that is troubled, underfunded, has issues, and the lump sum that they're offering to you is substantial enough, maybe that would eliminate consideration of an actual pension payment and the lump sum would make more sense. But I hear this all the time. Well, 90% of the people here take the lump sum when they leave. Well, 95% of people don't go to financial planners to learn how to look at this and analyze it and determine whether that's a good idea or not. So make sure it's not just because everyone else is doing it. That is a terrible reason to take the lump sum pension.
I agree. It goes back to, your mom's telling you if everyone was jumping off a bridge, would you?
Right.
So sometimes it's not good to follow the crowd. But again, we look at things differently with our concept of minimum dignity floor. We believe passionately in it. If you listen to our podcast, you know that. Our whole process revolves around that, and that's why we like pensions. But when you have as many pension choices as this couple is going to have, crunch some numbers, figure it all out. Look at longevity, be open and honest with each other about how long you guys could live, and if a shorter than average longevity is coming into play or not, or a longer than average. Because if you could live well into, who is that actress? Someone just died from Gone with the Wind, wasn't it? At 104?
Olivia de Havilland, didn't she? Isn't that who it was?
Yeah, who did she play?
104. She played the sister or friend of Scarlett O'Hara's character.
Oh, that's not the Wizard of Oz. Did I say Wizard of Oz?
I thought you were heading and going to say Gone with the Wind. So my mind was already thinking of that. She wasn't in Wizard of Oz. That was Judy Garland.
Judy Garland. No, she's not here. So it was a Gone with the Wind person.
Yes, and many other things. But she just passed the other day at 104.
104. Mm-hmm. So that's longevity. That beat the curve. So a lot to look at when you're contemplating. One thing I will say to all listeners, there are good financial planners out there and there's not so good financial planners out there. But if you find yourself a good planner who can help you crunch some numbers and not look to just try to sell you something or jam assets under management down your throat, look around, try to find someone to help you do these calculations. Or if not, we should be unpausing someday, Chris?
Oh, yeah. Fall's still looking pretty good.
Fall?
I still think early fall, hopefully, if things continue on.
Okay. So it is possible, COVID notwithstanding, especially Chris's 6 walking Petri dishes that live with him, as long as they can stay.
I'm getting rid of a couple of them. They're moving back out to their apartment. So
Petri dishes are leaving.
I'm going to get safer and safer every day.
Okay. So how many will be left in the house?
Two.
Oh, down from 6.
From 4 kids. My wife and I don't count. There'll be 4 total in the house.
I thought you had 6 kids.
I do, but they're old enough to be out and about now.
Oh, so there were 4 there, and you get rid of 2 more.
4 of the 6 were at home. We're going to get rid of 2 in the next couple of weeks, so we'll be back down to 2 kids.
Yeah. Okay, so that won't be too bad. They won't be polluting you too much.
No. And one of them lives in the basement, so
they're quarantined better and better, or not, yeah, okay.
He lives in the basement, so...
But anyways, barring any COVID issues, like the little scare we had that forced me into the attic, which I'll probably stay in until the scare goes away, barring any changes there, it is quite possible we'll be accepting new clients again into our planning process, and you can reach out to us. You don't have to wait until then if you wanted to chat with us just to see if we're going to be a good fit or not. So you could still reach out and schedule a meeting with us, and then hopefully Chris will be able to open the floodgates, if you will, and begin taking on new clients somewhere in the fall.
Yep.
All right.
Perfect.
That wraps up today's show.
Yep. So I want to thank everybody for listening to another Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. If you've got your own question that you'd like to submit, the best way to do that would be to go to the website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you can send us your question through the contact form there. You can also learn a little bit more about us and read a little bit more about our process and what we do here. But we really do appreciate everybody listening, and look forward to being with you for another show next week.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.